This is Dave Carrington, welcoming you to another edition of Squaring the Circle here on Celtica Radio, online, on mobile, and on digital wireless channel 915. Whenever the opportunity presents itself, we at Celtica Radio's Squaring the Circle like to try something new. And in this month's programme, we explore such an opportunity. I've delved into our mixed bag of contributions, and I've come up with an extract from the memoirs of a most distinguished hotelier by the name of Patrick L. Griffin. Academically, Patrick was not a gifted public school student. He emerged with few paper qualifications, but a highly developed entrepreneurial instinct and a sixth sense of knowing how to get the best out of challenging situations. These qualities, combined with his impeccable good manners, led him into the hotel industry, in which he was to create a lifelong and successful 50-year career. Like most in this business, he began as a trainee manager in English hotels, graduating to a more luxurious lifestyle in some fabulous places, where he met some of the world's rich, famous, and even notorious people along the way. He found his way to Australia, where he now lives, having opened two prestige hotels, which have hosted hundreds of public figures, stars of film, theatre, music, and society at large. The culmination of his life's work in Australia earned him the Order of Australia Medal, the equivalent of the Order of the British Empire in the UK. Whilst recuperating from illness, he and his co-writer Juliana Payne put together a trilogy of books under the collective title The Grand Life, Confessions of an Old School Hotelier in the Digital Age. The books span the whole of his hard-working and sometimes colourful life, each volume being liberally sprinkled with that essential page-turning ingredient, humour. His books entitled Part 1, The Grand Journey Begins, Part 2, The Grand Lessons Learned, and Part 3, The Grand Finale, are available in hard copy or e-books from www.patrickgriffin.info. The extract which I'm about to read is taken from part 1 of Patrick and Juliana's trilogy, pages 54 to 63. Incidentally, I have to say that it took a while to record because I was often overcome by irresistible urges to laugh out loud, even in so short an extract.
The fastest way to the internet.
islandwebservices.co.uk.
Island Web Services design and host bespoke websites for businesses and individuals. Professional websites start from just £100 with no hidden extras. Log on to find out more at islandwebservices.co.uk.
It's your apartment speaking, and I need some favors. When you're singing in the shower, just try going up a key. You're trying to be an alto when really you're a soprano. Oh, and if you could bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico, it's easy to do online and we could save money. And then, when you read your murder mysteries at night, could you read out loud? But skip the murder parts because I get scared.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Tune into the Language of Heaven, presented by Gareth Wynne-Jones on the Celtica Radio Mixed Cloud option. Listen to Seven Stars, featuring seven well-known Welsh language acts, hence the name, alongside some of the newest artists to join the Celtica Radio playlist. So that's Seven Stars with myself, Gareth Wynne-Jones, who will be delighted to have your company every month on the Celtica Radio Mixcloud option.
Radio. I now give you an extract from part one of The Grand Life by Patrick Griffin and Juliana Payne, read by me, Dave Carrington. I was not keen on boxing. The instructor was a sadist named Mr. Bennett. The part-time boxing coach, a retired army man, short in stature, who had not only distinguished himself in his fight against the Germans, but also in regimental boxing tournaments against others on his own side. Mr. Bennett was the man who supervised the programme and delighted in the fact that I was rather a tall boy for my age, with long arms. And, accordingly, these traits gave me some sort of advantage in his twisted moral universe. Quite naturally, not at all keen on the pain that accompanied an encounter with one's opponents. In the sheerest desperation of self-defense, I kept winning my bouts through simple tactics of avoidance. My unpalatable reward, however, was to be faced with ever more fearsome opponents. It was not long before my wholly unintended success in the ring led me to a place not unlike what I imagined purgatory to be, a South of England junior school boxing competition. This was not what I had in mind. Reluctantly, carrying the reputation of the school on my youthful shoulders, and yet inevitably drawn to the heady heights of popularity with my schoolmates that only such a suicidal venture could achieve, I headed for the first round in the competition. Soon, I would learn, as have many a vain celebrity, before and since, of the sadly ephemeral nature of such popularity. I felt like I'd gone back to the beginning of time. As I stepped into the ring, I found myself faced with a sweating Neanderthal from a competing school, who sported the wholly unsuitable and aristocratic name of Harrington Jones. As the first bell rang, we touched gloves. Surely, I thought, this sportsmanlike and symbolic act was not meant to inflict the pain that I suddenly felt in, of all places, my foot. Stupidly, I had assumed that I might suffer from a well-placed but gentlemanly blow above the belt. Instead, to my unending surprise, it appears that my opponent's foot was being utilized in exerting undue pressure squarely on the toe of the nearest of my overlarge feet, thus limiting my ability to retreat, which was uppermost in my mind at that moment. While still marveling at the pain being inflicted on this prominent and inherited Griffin legacy, I confusedly attempted to remove my huge foot from the vicinity of the gorilla with the hyphenated name. This minor act of self-preservation distracted me from seeing, ironically, that which I had been expecting, a legitimate left hook coming at lightning speed straight to my other, larger-than-average inherited feature, the Griffin nose. I understand why people think they see their lives flash by in moments of inordinate stress. In a split second, I managed to feel a blinding pain, to hear a crunch, to see flashes of light, and then fall back onto the canvas with a thud. I lay there gazing at the ring lights above, tasting salty blood gushing from my broken nose, aghast at the referee waving his hands maniacally from side to side. Was that it? Surely this is not what His Grace the Marquis of Queensbury had in mind. I'm almost certain that he did not intend for a foot to be used in such a manner. Adding to my mortification and disbelief was the uncanny fact that this injustice was not noticed by the referee. Hideously, though, every detail was noted by my school chums, and, in the way of boys since time immemorial, far from being supportive, they simply took the opportunity to rib me about my inherited features of feet like flippers and nose the size of a beak. Because of the role these characteristics played in my humiliation, I immediately and permanently became known as the Beak, or simply Penguin. As everything inevitably does, this was to haunt me in my later life. As decrepitude has caught up with its concomitant sleeping problems and complications like sleep apnea, I have sought the surgeon's advice. On viewing scans of my private inner sinuses, his first observation was, "I have never seen a nose quite like yours before." I groaned inwardly. Surely he was not going to regale me with the old school jokes. "You know it's been broken." The memory of childhood pugilism flooded back. "Yes, I did boxing at school." My response was, rightly I thought, rather proud, as I now sported my pugilistic scars with a sense of honour and achievement. "Obviously weren't very good at it," he muttered. Who'd have thought this throwaway line could hit me such a knockout blow? As I struggled to regain my erstwhile pride and honour, He lit up the X-ray. So far, I have counted your nose has been broken 5 times. No, wait a minute. 6 times. At this, I fell into silence, wondering, with fond affection, where the hell my parents had been whilst I was receiving such traumatic and life-threatening injuries. Oh, now I remember. When I did tentatively mention my concerns at being thrashed around the boxing ring, my father's solicitor's response was to doggedly search out his old World War II RAF kit bag, pack it, not with all his troubles, but with sand, and hang it up in the cellar as a frugal, homemade, post-war punching bag. He then instructed me to practice. Another of my encounters with discipline and the stiff upper lip, which was also known in those days as character building. A small silver medal commemorated this brief moment of fame and pain. This sat with pride on my bedroom sideboard. It was joined a year later by an equally diminutive cup for winning the 100-yard sprint at the school's annual sports day. By that time, I had learnt that there were people out there who could hurt you, and, as a consequence, had learnt to run quite fast. This simple yet highly pertinent philosophy I have believed in firmly during my life, and it has served me well. Unfortunately, even my modest sporting successes on the track or rugby field through the years put my academic efforts to shame. 1956 history. This appeals to his sense of the dramatic, but his answers are usually rather garbled. Maths. He has gone right back to his old days of being half asleep and not really trying. In the 1950s, the need to encourage and develop confidence in a child had yet to be recognised. In fact, the idea was more remote than the thought that man would walk on the moon. I have absolutely no idea what my parents thought as they read my school reports, but with humane and surprising vision, my father attempted to offer a sophisticated form of staged financial reward to encourage my academic improvement. Mystifyingly, considering my financial challenges, even this would not motivate me to do schoolwork. My tutors continued to sarcastically observe my complete lack of interest in academic pursuits. I dream of a time machine that could pluck Mr. Bryant out of his arcane headmaster's den and deposit him into my office today. I could modestly parade my achievements before him and politely ask him what he thought of his ever so constructive comments 60 years ago. What would today's psychology-trained teachers think of my performance? No doubt I'd be booked into special counselling before I could say, stiff upper lip. The idea in my day was that our youthful self-esteem was built up by learning of our shortcomings as human beings via the rapier pens of the teachers at the end of each term. We also had rather more instantaneous encouragement of the system of corporal punishment, the last resort for instilling a zest for learning in recalcitrant boys. I found myself numbered amongst this motley crew. One day, for some reason, I hadn't completed my homework for the third time and was invited to join the boys in detention. This event was cordially accompanied by an invitation to join the headmaster in his study. A caning was very much a ceremonial occasion, as much for the entire school as for the individual. At the end of lunch, before being dismissed to retire to our classrooms where we could either rest our heads on our desk or pretend to read our books in silence, the headmaster would read out a list of names, all of whom were invited to report to his study. I knew what lay ahead, but with my unending youthful optimism, I was certain that I would be saved by an earthquake or an announcement declaring the outbreak of another war. Sadly, neither catastrophe eventuated, and the voice intoned, "Griffin? Harris?" The other boys filed out, and Harris and I peeled away to quiver outside the large, highly polished door, emblazoned in gilt with the single word in uppercase times, "Headmaster." I paused, still waiting for earthquakes, war, tsunami. Nothing yet. I stepped forward and knocked on the door. The firm tenor voice spake, "Enter." The door opened with a creak of unoiled hinges. Come in, boy. Don't dawdle. I entered the large oak-panelled study, which had the air of a museum. A large desk in the window bay, a filing cabinet, a bentwood coat stand, and a Victorian elephant's foot walking stick stand. Ominously, this one contained no walking sticks, but instead a sadist's dream collection of canes, riding crops, and lengths of bamboo sticks, all chosen for their ability to show a boy the error of his ways. I expected to see the headmaster sitting there in a red judge's cape whilst donning the black square of cloth that so many prisoners knew to be the scrap that heralded their impending death. I felt like an aristocrat before the French Revolutionary Court in A Tale of Two Cities, but where was my Sidney Carton to unselfishly stand in for me at the guillotine? It is a far, far better thing that I do. Judge-like, the headmaster went through all the reasons as to why I found myself standing before him. I don't know why he thought that I didn't know and needed to hear it all again. Eventually he arrived at, "Do you have anything to say?" Under advice, I had practiced my earnest response. "Sorry, sir, I will not let it happen again." A hollow promise if ever there was one. "Well, I am also sorry, boy, as this will hurt me more than it will hurt you." Another hollow promise. Was the world always so perfidious? "Go and stand over there." The Spanish Inquisition had had no more terrible torquemada than he, and I was being burnt my own personal auto-da-fe. I moved to the corner. The headmaster set about the ritual that was in itself a cleverly designed form of medieval torture, intended to highlight the victim's fear of the moment. Standing up, he carefully removed his cape and hung it on the bentwood coat stand. Next removed was the Harris Tweed country sports jacket, and then, carefully, the enamelled Oxford University crested cufflink from his right cuff was extracted. He placed it in a cut-down 2-pounder anti-tank shelf that served, rather morbidly, as his desk ornament. As I watched, still praying for the earthquake, he slowly rolled his right sleeve up above his elbow. The headmaster moved to the elephant's footstand. Why was everything in this office reminiscent of death? He removed a bamboo cane that the boys had already christened Mr. Knobbly. He inflicted a practice swing at the air, which made a sound like a whoosh. But Mr. Knobbly is consigned back to the stand as the headmaster opted for another. He sorted through his bizarre collection as if looking for a 9-iron, found what he sought, and swung it once through the air. Oh dear God, it's Mr. Whippy, one of the most feared instruments, recognised for its downward speed that the boys are convinced will beat Chuck Yeager in breaking the sound barrier. Over there, he pointed to the centre of the wall. Bend over, closer to the wall. A cunning and cruel tactic, as the prisoner now had insufficient room to follow the natural reaction in standing up quickly once struck. In addition, in the event he tried, he will receive a bonus punishment of a sharp crack on the head as it comes into contact with the wall to remind him not to stand up to escape further pain. The cane was next gently prodded at the prisoner's gluteus maximus. This procedure has been found to be necessary following the shocking discovery that boys were using school blotting paper tucked into their underpants in the belief that its magical qualities would absorb the sting of the cane. I was now prepared to throw pride to the wind and myself to the floor and beg for mercy. I don't know whether it was a good or a bad thing, but the stiff upper lip kicked in and I held my ground. 1957 Headmaster's Report. Patrick is by nature very pleasant and easygoing, and this does, I fear, extend to his work, but not to the degree of willful laziness. I doubt if slave driving would benefit him. In fact, I think the reverse. Signed, W.T. Bryant. The ritual fast approached its climax. I watched, upside down, from between my legs, as, carefully, with measured strides, he walked back towards his desk. He turned as if he was about to bowl a very fast leg break to an Australian batsman. He raised his arm and started his run-up. At this stage, I closed my eyes and awaited the stinging pain as Mr. Whippy impacted with the ferocity of willow striking leather. In this instance, the willow struck my very tender 9-year-old backside. My fears were not disappointed, and it hurt like hell. The headmaster started measuring his stride back to his crease. Good God, I have to face an over of these insane deliveries. At last, the auto de fe came to an end. I shuffle, stand up, turn, and shake the headmaster by the hand in the time-honored manner. Thank you, sir. I leave him thus to his dressing, so as to enable him to start the ritual over again from the beginning with the new prisoner. As I totter from the headmaster's study, I catch the strange mix of sympathy and apprehension that runs across Harris's visage. He is next to face the onslaught of the county's ex-bowler. 1957 Headmaster's Report. Patrick's relapse is very disappointing indeed. I'm afraid it's partially due to his own want of self-confidence in his ability. Signed, W.T. Bryant. Staggering to the classroom, I fought back the tears bravely. The strength of emotion was evoked as much by the tortuous elongation of the ritual itself as from any actual pain in my nether regions. As I entered the room, all eyes swiveled in my direction. Up or down? Mouths hurled silently. That was a query in all the boys' minds. It was concerned with whether Mr. Whippy had been administered with trousers up or down. Down was usually reserved for more serious offences. Up, I silently enunciated to satisfy their lurid interest. I sat down and bounced back up like a jack-in-a-box. The sensitivity of my recent experience was felt most acutely. This immediately set off a huge chuckle from the class and received visual daggers from the teacher. Years of self-discipline and close study have made him totally impervious to my, or indeed any boy's, suffering. Griffin, stop clowning around or I'll send you back to the headmaster. No sooner had I carefully adjusted myself onto the hard wooden seat than the school bell rang for the start of the increasingly misnamed rest period. With this, we exited the classroom and, surrounded by my classmates, I was almost swept off my feet in the rush to get to the locker rooms. We met up with Harris, who was immediately dragged into and submerged in the throng. Come on then, drop them, let's see the stripes, came the chorus. Proudly, Harris and I turned, unclipped our school belts and carefully lowered our grey shorts and white underpants. A sudden collective gasp. Hey Griffin, you've scored blood. Now, I had earned a real Medal of Honour, which brought great admiration in a way that my little silver cup and medal never did. The pain faded in inverse proportion to the swelling pride that I felt at being so highly respected for handling pain with such fortitude. I carefully felt my bottom, feeling 6 distinct ridges. In the mirror I could see they were already turning shades of black and blue, with a few streaks of red seeping through. Just as I was savouring the oohs and ahs that accompanied my newfound fame, the bell rang again. At that moment, I learned what many more popular celebrities have not learned. With the sound of the bell and a new focus for the boys, my fame and renown disappeared at the same speed with which it had arrived. Before I'd finished reveling in it, it disappeared and I fell back to earth and the disciplined routine of school with a thump. And so we wrap up for this month another Squaring the Circle here on Celtica Radio. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the extract from part one of Patrick Griffin and Juliana's trilogy under the overarching title of The Grand Life. If listeners would like to purchase an e-copy of any or all of the 3 parts of the Grand Life trilogy, they can get a 25% discount by quoting the code Celtica, that's CELTICA, when they purchase direct from Patrick's website. And that address again is www.patrickgriffin.info. Now, I know I keep saying this, but I always need new and original stories for Squaring the Circle. So, if you're a writer, or even an aspiring writer, and want to get your material on this programme, please send it in a Word-compatible document to dave.carrington@celticradio.com. It can be fiction of any genre, and up to a length of around 3,500 words. If you prefer, send me a recording of it. Don't worry too much about the final background tweaks. We can get those sorted here at the station. You've been listening to Squaring the Circle on Celtica Radio, the world's local radio station. And whatever time it is in your world right now, this is Dave Carrington wishing you all a very good morning, a good afternoon, good evening, or good night. Celtica Radio.